heard us speak parables in the white man's language. He knew my name, my brothers, and those of my friends. He remembered us from performances we had done. None of us knew him, not even by his face, but we warmly smiled as if we recognized him as well. He saved our lives. We were untied and treated to some cassava and smoked fish. We ate, thanked the villagers, and got ready to move on. The chief and some of the men who had tied our hands and feet offered us a place to stay in the village. We thanked them for their generosity and left. We knew that the rebels would eventually reach the village. Slowly, we walked on a path through a thick forest. The trees hesitantly swayed with the quiet wind. The sky looked as if it was filled with smoke, endless gray smoke that made the sun dull. Around sunset, we arrived at an abandoned village with 6 mud houses. We sat on the floor of the veranda of one of the houses. I looked at Junior, whose face was sweating. He had been so quiet lately. He looked at me and smiled a little before his face resumed its dullness. He got up and walked out to the yard. Never moving, he stared at the sky until the sun disappeared. On his way back to sit on the veranda, he picked up a stone and played with it throughout the evening. I kept looking at him, hoping that we could have another eye contact, and maybe he would then say something about what was going on in his head, but he wouldn't look up. He only played with the stone in his hand and stared at the ground. Once, Junior taught me how to skip a stone on a river. We had gone to fetch water, and he told me he had learned a new magic that let him make stones walk on water. Bending his body sideways, he threw stones out, and each one walked on the water farther than the last. He told me to try, but I couldn't do it. He promised to teach me the magic some other time. As we were walking back home with buckets of water on our heads, I slipped and fell, spilling the water. Junior gave me his bucket, took my empty one, and returned to the river. When he came home, the first thing he did was ask me if I was hurt from falling. I told him I was fine, but he examined my knees and elbows anyway, and when he was done, he tickled me. As I looked at him that evening, sitting on the veranda of a house in an unknown village, I wanted him to ask me if I was fine. Jibrilla, Talui, Kaloko, and Kalilu were all looking at the top of the forest that engulfed the village. Jibrilla's nose twitched as he sat with his chin on his knee. When he exhaled, his whole body moved. Talui continuously tapped his foot on the floor as if trying to distract himself from thinking about the present. Kaloko was restless. He couldn't sit still and kept switching positions and sighed each time he did so. Kalilu sat quietly. His face showed no emotion and his spirit seemed to have wandered away from his body. I wanted to know how Junior was feeling, but I couldn't find the right moment to break into the silence of that evening. I wish I had. The following morning, a large group of people passed through the village. Among the travelers was a woman who knew Jibrilla. She told him that his aunt was in a village about 30 miles from where we were. She gave us directions. We filled our pockets with unripe oranges that were sour and unbearable to eat, but the only source of food at our disposal, and we were on our way. Kamator was very far away from Matrujong, where the rebels were still in control, but the villagers were on guard and ready to move any time. In return for food and a place to sleep, the 6 of us were appointed watchmen. 3 miles from the village was a big hill. From the top, one could see as far as a mile down the path toward the village. It was at the top of that hill that we stood watch from early in the morning until nightfall. We did this for about a month and nothing happened. Still, we knew the rebels well enough to brace for their arrival, but we lost our vigilance to the gradual passing of time. The season for planting was approaching. The first rain had fallen, softening the soil. Birds began building their nests in the mango trees. Dew came down every morning and left the leaves wet and soaked the soil. The odor of the soaked soil was irresistibly sharp at midday. It made me want to roll on the ground. One of my uncles used to joke that he would like to die at this time of year. The sun rose earlier than usual and was at its brightest in the blue, almost cloudless sky. The grass on the side of the path was half dry and half green. Ants could be seen on the ground carrying food into their holes. Even though we tried to convince them otherwise, the villagers grew certain the rebels weren't coming, and so they ordered us from our scouting post and out into the fields. It wasn't easy. I had always been a spectator of the art of farming, and as a result, never realized how difficult it was until those few months of my life in 1993, when I had to assist in farming in the village of Kamato. The village inhabitants were all farmers, so I had no way to escape this fate. Before the war, when I visited my grandmother during harvest season, the only thing she let me do was pour wine on the soil around the farm before harvest commenced, as part of a ceremony to thank the ancestors and the gods for providing fertile soil, healthy rice, and a successful farming year. The first task we were given was to clear a massive plot of land the size of a football field. When we went to look at the bush that was supposed to be cut, I knew tough days lay ahead. The bush was thick and there were lots of palm trees, each surrounded by trees that had woven their branches together. It was difficult to get around them and chop them down. The ground was covered with decayed leaves that had changed the top color of the brown soil to dark. Termites could be heard rummaging under the rotten leaves. Every day, we would repeatedly stoop and stand under the bushes, swinging machetes and axes at the trees and palms that had to be cut lower to the ground so that they wouldn't grow fast again and disrupt the crop that was to be planted. Sometimes when we swung the machetes and axes, their weight would send us flying into the bushes, where we would lie for a bit and rub our aching shoulders. Jabrila's uncle would shake his head and say, "You lazy town boys." On the first morning of clearing, Jabrila's uncle assigned each of us a portion of the bush to be cut down. We spent 3 days cutting down our portions. He was done in less than 3 hours. When I had the cutlass in my hand to start attacking the bush, Jabrila's uncle couldn't help himself. He burst out laughing before he showed me how to hold the cutlass properly. I spent restless minutes swinging the cutlass with all my might at trees that he would cut with one strike. The first 2 weeks were extremely painful. I suffered from back pains and muscle aches. Worst of all, the flesh on the palms of my hands was peeled, swollen, and blistered. My hands were not used to holding a machete or an axe. After the clearing was done, the bush was left to dry. Later, when the cut bush was dried, we set fire to it and watched the thick smoke rise to the blue summer sky. Next, we had to plant cassava. To do this, we dug mini holes in the ground using hoes. To take a break from this task, which required us to bend our upper bodies toward the ground for hours, we fetched cassava stalks, cut them into shorter pieces, and placed them in the holes. The only sounds we heard as we walked were the humming of tunes by expert farmers, the occasional flapping of a bird, the snaps of tree branches breaking in the nearby forest, and hellos from neighbors traveling the path, either to their own farms or back to the village. At the end of the day, I sometimes would sit on a log at the village square and watch the younger boys play their wrestling games. One of the boys, about 7, always started a fight, and his mother would pull him away by his ear. I saw myself in him. I was a troublesome boy as well and always got into fights in school and at the river. Sometimes I stoned kids I couldn't beat up. Since we didn't have a mother at home, Junior and I were the misfits in our community. The separation of our parents left marks on us that were visible to the youngest child in our town. We became the evening gossip. "Those poor boys," some would say, "they aren't going to have a good and complete training," others would worryingly remark as we walked by. I was so angry at the way they pitied us that sometimes I would kick their children's behinds at school, especially those who gave us the look that said, "My parents talk about you a lot." We farmed for 3 months at Kamato, and I never got used to it. The only times I enjoyed were the afternoon breaks, when we went swimming in the river. There, I would sit on the clear sandy bottom of the river and let the current take me downstream, where I would resurface, put on my dirty clothes, and return to the farm. The sad thing about all that hard labor was that, in the end, it all went to ruin, because the rebels did eventually come, and everyone ran away, leaving their farms to be covered by weeds and devoured by animals. It was during that attack in the village of Kamato that my friends and I separated. It was the last time I saw Junior, my older brother. Chapter 7. The attack happened unexpectedly one night. There hadn't even been any rumors that the rebels were as close as 50 miles from Kamato. They just walked into the village from out of nowhere. It was about 8 p.m. when people were performing the last prayer of the day. The imam was oblivious to what was going on until it was too late. He stood in front of everyone facing east, vigorously reciting a long surah, and once prayer had started, no one was allowed to say anything that was not related to the performance of the prayer. I didn't go to the mosque that night, but Kaloko did. He said that upon realizing that the rebels were in the village, everyone quickly and silently left the mosque, one at a time, leaving the imam by himself as he stood there leading the prayer. Some people tried to whisper to him, but he ignored them. The rebels captured him and demanded to know what parts of the forest people were hiding in, but the imam refused to tell them. They bound his hands and feet with wire, tied him to an iron post, and set fire to his body. They didn't burn him completely, but the fire killed him. His semi-burnt remains were left in the village square. Kaloko said he saw this from the nearby bush where he hid. During the attack, Junior was in the veranda room where all five of us slept. I was outside, sitting on the steps. I had no time to go look for him, since the attack was sudden, but instead had to run into the bush alone. That night, I slept by myself, leaning on a tree. In the morning, I found Kaloko, and together we returned to the village. The semi-burnt body of the imam, as Kaloko had described it, was there in the village square. I could see the pain he had felt by looking at the way his teeth were bared. All the houses were burned. There wasn't a sign of life anywhere. We looked in the thick forest for Junior and our friends, but they weren't anywhere to be found. We stumbled across a family we knew and they let us hide with them in the bush by the swamp. We stayed with them for 2 weeks. 2 weeks that felt like months. Each day went by very slowly as I busied myself thinking about what other possibilities lay ahead. Was there an end to this madness? And was there any future for me beyond the bushes? I thought about Junior, Jibrila, Taloi, and Kaloko. Had they been able to escape the attack? I was losing everyone, my family, my friends. I remembered when my family moved to Mogbemo. My father held a ceremony to bless our new home. He invited our new neighbors, and my father stood up during the ceremony and said, "I pray to the gods and ancestors that my family will always be together." He looked at us. My mother held my little brother, and Junior and I stood next to each other, with toffee in our mouths. One of the elders stood up and added to what my father had said, "I pray to the gods and ancestors that your family will always be together, even when one of you cross into the spirit world. To family and community." The old man raised his open hands in the air. My father came over and stood by my mother and motioned for Junior and I to come closer. We did, and my father put his arms around us. The gathering clapped, and the photographer took a few snapshots. I pressed my fingers on my eyelids to hold back my tears and wished that I could have my family together again. Once every 3 days, we visited Kamato to see if people had returned. But each visit was in vain as there wasn't a sign of a living thing. The silence in the village was too scary. I was scared when the wind blew, shaking the thatched roofs, and I felt as if I were out of my body wandering somewhere. There weren't footprints of any kind. Not even a lizard dared to crawl through the village. The birds and crickets didn't sing. I could hear my footsteps louder than my heartbeat. During these visits, we brought with us brooms so that we could sweep away our footprints as we went back to our hiding place to avoid being followed. The last time Kaloko and I visited the village, dogs were feasting on the burnt remains of the imam. One dog had his arm and the other his leg. Above, vultures circled, preparing to descend on the body as well. I became frustrated with living in fear. I felt as if I was always waiting for death to come to me. So I decided to go somewhere where, at least, there was some peace. Kaloko was afraid to leave. He thought that by leaving the bush, we would be walking toward death. He decided to stay in the swamp. I had nothing to carry, so I filled my pockets with oranges, tied the laces of my tattered crepes, and I was ready to go. I said goodbye to everyone and headed west. As soon as I left the hiding area and was on the path, I felt as if I was being wrapped in a blanket of sorrow. It came over me instantly. I started to cry. I didn't know why. Maybe it was because I was afraid of what might lie ahead. I sat on the side of the path for a while until my tears were gone, and then moved on. I walked all day and didn't run into a single person on the path or in the villages that I passed through. There were no footprints to be seen, and the only sounds I heard were those of my breathing and my footsteps. For 5 days, I walked from dawn to dusk, never coming in contact with any human being. At night, I slept in abandoned villages. Every morning, I made my own fate by deciding which way I was going to go. My goal was to avoid walking in the direction from where I had come. I ran out of oranges on the first day, but I collected more at every village that I slept in. Sometimes I would come across cassava farms. I would uproot some and eat them raw. The other food that was available in most villages was coconut. I didn't know how to climb a coconut tree. I had tried, but it was just impossible, until one day when I was very hungry and thirsty, I arrived at a village where there was nothing to eat except for the coconuts that sloppily hung from the tree, as if teasing me, daring me to pluck them. It is difficult to explain how it happened, but I mounted the coconut tree quite fast and unexpectedly. By the time I realized what I was doing and thought about my inexperience in this particular art, I was already at the top of the branches and plucking coconuts. I climbed down just as quickly and looked around for something to crack them with. Luckily, I found an old machete and got to work on the coconut shells. After I was done snacking, I found myself a hammock and rested for a while. I got up, well rested, and thought, I think I have enough energy now to climb and pick more coconuts for the road. But it was impossible. I couldn't even climb past the middle of the trunk. I tried again and again, but each attempt was more pitiful than the last. I hadn't laughed for a long time, but this made me laugh uncontrollably. I could have written a science paper on the experience. On the sixth day, I came in contact with humans. I had just left the village that I slept in the previous night and was on my way to look for another one when I heard voices ahead of me, rising and fading as the wind changed direction. I got off the path and walked carefully, minding my footsteps on the dried leaves in the forest to avoid making any sound. I stood behind the bushes, watching the people I had heard. There were 8 of them down at the river, 4 young boys about 12 years old my age, 2 girls, a man and a woman. They were swimming. After observing for a while and determining that they were harmless, I decided to go down to the river for a swim as well. In order to avoid scaring them, I walked back to the path and headed toward them. The man was the first to see me. "Kusheo, howdy bodisa," I greeted him. His eyes searched my smiling face. He didn't say anything, and I thought maybe he didn't speak Creole. So I said hello in Mende, my tribal language. "Boa, bigahuyena." He still didn't respond. I took my clothes off and dived into the river. When I rose to the surface, all of them had stopped swimming but remained in the water. The man, who must have been the father, asked me, "Where are you from and where are you going?" He was Mende and he understood Creole very well. "I am from Matrujong and I have no idea where I am going." I wiped the water off my face and then continued, "Where are you and your family headed?" He ignored my question by pretending he didn't hear me. I proceeded to ask him if he knew the fastest way to Bont, an island in the south of Sierra Leone and one of the safest places at that time, according to hearsay. He told me that if I kept walking toward the sea, I would eventually find people who might have a better understanding about how to get to Bont. It was clear from the tone of his voice that he didn't want me around and didn't trust me. I looked at the curious and skeptical faces of the children and the woman. I was glad to see other faces and at the same time disappointed that the war had destroyed the enjoyment of the very experience of meeting people. Even a 12-year-old couldn't be trusted anymore. I got out of the water, thanked the man, and was on my way, heading in the direction he had pointed that led toward the sea. Sadly, I do not know the names of most of the villages that sheltered and provided me food during those times. No one was there to ask, and in those parts of the country, there aren't any signs that said the name of this or that village. Chapter 8. I walked for 2 days straight without sleeping. I stopped only at streams to drink water. I felt as if somebody was after me. Often my shadow would scare me and cause me to run for miles. Everything felt awkwardly brutal. Even the air seemed to want to attack me and break my neck. I knew I was hungry, but I didn't have the appetite to eat or the strength to find food. I had passed through burnt villages where dead bodies of men, women, and children of all ages were scattered like leaves on the ground after a storm. Their eyes still showed fear, as if death hadn't freed them from the madness that continued to unfold. I had seen heads cut off by machetes, smashed by cement bricks, and rivers filled with so much blood that the water had ceased flowing. Each time my mind replayed these scenes, I increased my pace. Sometimes I closed my eyes hard to avoid thinking, but the eye of my mind refused to be closed and continued to plague me with images. My body twitched with fear, and I became dizzy. I could see the leaves on the trees swaying, but I couldn't feel the wind. On the third day, I found myself in the middle of a thick forest, standing beneath huge trees whose leaves and branches made it difficult to see the sky. I didn't remember how I'd gotten there. Night was approaching, so I found a suitable tree that wasn't too high to climb. It had weaved branches with another to form something like a hammock. I spent the night in the arms of those trees, between earth and sky. The next morning, I was determined to find my way out of the forest, even though my back ached painfully from sleeping in the trees. On my way, I came to a spring that ran from under a gigantic rock. I sat by it to rest, and there I had eye contact with a huge dark snake that retreated behind a bush. I found a long, strong stick to protect myself as I sat playing with the leaves on the ground to avoid bringing up thoughts that occupied my mind. But my mind continued to torment me, and every effort to clear away the terrible thoughts was in vain. So I decided to walk, tapping the ground with the stick I held. I walked all morning and into the evening, but in the end found myself at the same place where I had slept the previous night. That was when I finally came to accept that I was lost, and it was going to take a while to get out of where I was. I decided to make my new home a little bit more comfortable by adding leaves to the weaved branches to make them less hard to sleep on. I walked around to familiarize myself with my vicinity. As I was getting acquainted with my new home, I cleared the dried leaves. Then I took a stick and drew lines on the ground from my sleeping place to the spring where I had met my new neighbor, the snake. There was another one drinking water, and it became motionless upon seeing me. As I went about my business, I heard it crawling away. I drew lines by parting the dried leaves on the ground. These lines helped me from getting lost in between the spring and my sleeping place. After I finished familiarizing myself with the area, I sat down and tried to think about how I was going to get out of the forest. But that didn't go well since I was afraid of thinking. I eventually decided that maybe it was better to be where I was. Even though I was lost and lonely, it was safe for the time being. Along the spring, there were several trees with a ripe fruit that I had never seen. Birds came to eat the strange fruit every morning. I decided to try some of it, since it was the only edible thing around. It was either take the chance and eat this fruit that might poison me, or die of hunger. I decided to eat the fruit. I thought if the birds ate it and lived, maybe I could too. The fruit was shaped like a lemon, with an outer layer of mixed color of yellow and red. Inside was a crusty, watery, fruity part, with a very tiny seed. It smelled like a mixture of ripe mango, orange, and something else that was irresistibly inviting. Hesitantly, I plucked one and took a bite. It didn't taste as good as it smelled, but it was satisfying. I must have had about 12 of them. Afterward, I drank some water and sat waiting for the result. I thought about when Junior and I had visited Kabati and would take walks with our grandfather on paths around the coffee farms by the village. He would point out medicinal leaves and trees whose barks were important medicines. During each visit, Grandfather always gave us a special medicine that was supposed to enhance the brain's capacity to absorb and retain knowledge. He made this medicine by writing a special Arabic prayer on a wale, a slate, with ink that was made of another medicine. The writing was then washed off the slate, and that water, which they called nesi, was put in a bottle. We took it with us and were supposed to keep it a secret and drink it before we studied for exams. This medicine worked. during my primary school years and part of my secondary school years, I was able to permanently retain everything that I learned. Sometimes it worked so well that during examinations I could visualize my notes and all that was written on each page of my textbooks. It was as if the books had been imprinted inside my head. This wonder was one of many in my childhood. To this day, I have an excellent photographic memory that enables me to remember details of the day-to-day moments of my life indelibly. I looked around the forest for one of the medicinal leaves that grandfather had said remove poison from the body. I might need it if the fruit I had eaten was poisonous, but I couldn't find the plant. Nothing happened after a couple of hours, so I decided to take a bath. I hadn't had time to take one for a while. My clothes were dirty, my crepes were rotten, and my body was sticky with dirt. When I first threw water on my skin, it became slimy. There was no soap, but in the forest there was an area that had a particular kind of grass that could be used as a substitute. I had learned about this grass during one of the summers when I visited my grandmother. When I squeezed a bunch of the grasses together, they provided foam that left my body with a fresh scent. After I had finished taking a bath, I washed my clothes, or rather soaked and spread them on the grass to dry. I sat naked, cleaning my teeth with sapwood. A deer came by and watched me suspiciously before it went about its affairs. I resisted thinking by listening to the sound of the forest, as songs of birds collided with the shouting of monkeys and the cackle of baboons. By evening, my clothes were still damp, so I put them on so that the heat of my body would dry them faster before nightfall. I was still alive, despite eating the nameless fruit, so I ate some more for dinner. The following morning, I ate some more for breakfast and later for lunch and dinner again. The nameless fruit became my only source of food. The fruit was plentiful, but I knew that sooner or later there would be no more. Sometimes, I felt as if the birds gave me angry looks for eating so much of their food. The most difficult part of being in the forest was the loneliness. It became unbearable each day. One thing about being lonesome is that you think too much, especially when there isn't much else you can do. I didn't like this and I tried to stop myself from thinking, but nothing seemed to work. I decided to just ignore every thought that came to my head because it brought too much sadness. Apart from eating and drinking water and once every other day taking a bath, I spent most of my time fighting myself mentally in order to avoid thinking about what I had seen or wondering where my life was going, where my family and friends were. The more I resisted thinking, the longer the days became, and I felt as if my head was becoming heavier each passing day. I became restless and was afraid to sleep for fear that my suppressed thoughts would appear in my dreams. As I searched the forest for more food and to find a way out, I feared coming in contact with wild animals such as leopards, lions, and wild pigs. So I stayed closer to trees that I could easily mount to hide myself from these animals. I walked as fast as I could, but the more I walked, the more it seemed I was getting deeper into the thickness of the forest. The harder I tried to get out, the bigger and taller the trees became. This was a problem because it got difficult to find a tree that was easy to climb and had suitable branches to sleep in. One evening, as I searched for a tree with a forked branch to sleep in, I heard grunts. I wasn't exactly sure what animals were producing such noisy grunts, but they became louder. I climbed a tree to be safe. As I sat there, a herd of wild pigs came running. It was the first time I had seen wild pigs, and they were huge, all of them. If they stood up, they would all be taller than me. Each had forked teeth extending out of its mouth. As they passed underneath me, one of the biggest pigs stopped and sniffed the air in all directions. It must have sensed my presence. When they were gone, I climbed down, and all of a sudden a couple of enormous pigs came running at me. They chased me for about half a mile as I looked for a tree to climb. Fortunately, I found one that I was able to mount in one jump. The pigs stopped and started charging at the bottom of the tree. They grunted loudly and the rest of the herd came back. They all started charging at the tree and tried to chew the bottom. I climbed higher and higher. After a while, they finally gave up as a cricket started calling for night to commence. My grandmother once told me a story about a notorious hunter of wild pigs who used magic to transform himself into a wild boar. He would then lead the herd into an open area of the forest where he would change back into human form, then trap and shoot the pigs. One day during his trickery, a small pig saw the hunter biting a plant that enabled him to return to his human form. The pig told all of its companions what it had seen. The herd searched the forest for the hunter's magic plant and destroyed every single one of them. The next day, the hunter performed his trickery and lured the herd into an opening. But he couldn't find the plant to become human again. The pigs tore him into pieces. Since that day, the white pigs have distrusted all humans, and whenever they see a person in the forest, they think he or she is there to avenge the hunter. After the pigs had gone and I surveyed the terrain to my satisfaction, I climbed down and continued walking. I wanted to be away from that area before dawn, since I feared that if I stayed, I might run into the wild pigs again. I walked all night and continued during the day. At the beginning of night, I saw owls coming from their hiding places, revolving their eyes and stretching to become familiar with their surroundings and get ready for the night. I was walking very fast but very quietly, until I accidentally stepped on the tail of a snake. It started hissing and scuttling toward me. I ran as fast as I could for a long time. When I was 6, my grandfather had inserted a medicine into my skin that protected me from snake bite and enabled me to control snakes. But as soon as I started school, I began to doubt the power of the medicine. After that, I was no longer able to make snakes stop in their tracks until I went by. When I was very little, my father used to say, "If you are alive, there is hope for a better day and something good to happen. If there is nothing good left in the destiny of a person, he or she will die." I thought about these words during my journey, and they kept me moving, even when I didn't know where I was going. Those words became the vehicle that drove my spirit forward and made it stay alive. I had spent more than a month in the forest when I finally ran into people again. The only living things I had met were monkeys, snakes, wild pigs, and deer, none of which I could have a conversation with. Sometimes I watched the little monkeys practice jumping from tree to tree or watched the curious eyes of a deer that sensed my presence. The sounds of branches snapping off trees became my music. There were certain days when the sound of the branches breaking made a consistent rhythm that I would enjoy very much, and the sonority of it would echo for a while and would gradually fade into the depths of the forest. I was walking slowly, staggering from hunger, back pain, and fatigue when I ran into some young people my age at an intersection where two paths merged into one. I was wearing a pair of trousers I had recently found hanging on a pole in an abandoned village. They were extremely big for me, so I tied them with ropes so they wouldn't fall off while I walked. We all arrived at the junction at the same time, and upon seeing each other, we became paralyzed with fear. As I stood there, unable to run, I recognized a few of the faces and I smiled to break the tension and uncertainty. There were 6 boys, and 3 of them, Alhaji, Musa, and Kene, had attended Centennial Secondary School with me in Matrujong. They weren't close friends, but the 4 of us had been flogged once for talking back to the senior prefect. We had nodded at one another after that punishment, which we all agreed was unnecessary. I shook hands with the boys. I could tell who was from what tribe by the marks on their cheeks and their features. Alhaji and Saidu were Timini, and Kene, Juma, Musa, and Moriba were Mende. They told me they were heading for a village called Yile in Bont District that they had heard was safe because it was occupied by the Sierra Leone armed forces. Quietly, I followed them as I tried to remember all their names, especially the names of the faces I recognized among them. I walked in the back, creating a little distance between us. I began to realize how uncomfortable I felt being around people. Kene, who was older, perhaps 16, asked me where I had been. I smiled without answering. He tapped me on the shoulder as if he knew what I had experienced. "Circumstances will change and things will be fine. Just hold on a little more," he said, tapping my shoulder again and nodding. I responded with a smile. Once again, I was with a group of boys. This time, there were 7 of us. I knew this was going to be a problem, but I didn't want to be by myself anymore. Our innocence had been replaced by fear, and we had become monsters. There was nothing we could do about it. Sometimes we ran after people shouting that we were not what they thought, but this made them more scared. We hoped to ask people for directions. It was impossible. We had traveled for more than 6 days when we came in contact with a very old man who could barely walk. He sat on the veranda of a house in the middle of the village. His face was too wrinkled to still be alive, yet his dark skin was shiny and he spoke slowly, gobbling the words in his jaws before he let them out. As he spoke, the veins on his forehead became visible through his skin. Everyone ran when they heard of the seven boys on their way here. I couldn't run at all, so they left me behind. No one was willing to carry me, and I didn't want to be a burden, he said. We explained to him where we were from and where we wanted to go. He asked us to stay for a while and keep him company. You young fellows must be hungry. There are some yams in that hut over there. Can you boys cook some for me and yourselves? He politely asked. When we were almost finished eating the yams, he said slowly, My children, this country has lost its good heart. People don't trust each other anymore. Years ago, you would have been heartily welcomed in this village. I hope that you boys can find safety before this untrustworthiness and fear cause someone to harm you. He drew a map on the ground with his walking stick. This is how you get to Yile, he said. What is your name? Kene asked the old man. He smiled as if he knew that one of us would ask this question. There's no need to know my name. Just refer to me as the old man who got left behind when you get to the next village. He looked at all our faces and spoke softly with no sadness in his voice. I will not be alive to see the end of this war. So to save a place in your memories for other things, I won't tell you my name. If you survive this war, just remember me as the old man you met. You boys should be on your way. He pointed his staff toward the path that lay ahead of us. As we walked away, he erased the map with his foot and waved us off with a raised right hand and a nod. Before the village disappeared from our sight, I turned around to take one last look at the old man. His head was down and he had both hands on his staff. It was clear to me that he knew his days would soon be over and he didn't bother to be afraid for himself, but he was for us. Someone has started a rumor about the seven boys, us. Many times during our journey, we were surrounded by muscular men with machetes who almost killed us before they realized that we were just children running away from the war. Sometimes I look at the blade of the machetes and thought about how much it would hurt to be chopped with one. Other times, I was so hungry and tired that I didn't care. At crowded villages where we sometimes stopped to spend the night, the men stayed up to keep an eye on us. When we went to the river to wash our faces, mothers would grab their children and run home. Chapter 9. One morning, immediately after we had passed the deserted village, we started hearing something like the roar of big engines, the rolling of metal drums on a tar road, a thunder exploding, roll after roll. All these sounds reached our ears simultaneously. We hurriedly deviated from the path, running into the bushes and lying on the ground. We searched one another's faces for an explanation of the strange sound. Even Kene, who sometimes had answers, couldn't tell us what we were hearing. We all looked at him and his face contorted with confusion. We have to find out what it is, or we can't continue on to Yile, Kene whispered, and then began to crawl toward the sound. We followed him, quietly dragging our bodies on rotten leaves. As we got closer, the sound intensified and a heavy breeze shook the trees above us. We could clearly see the blue sky, but nothing else. Kene hesitantly sat on his heels and surveyed the area. It is just water. Lots of it. And sand. Lots of it. Kene was still looking. What is making the noise then? Alaji asked. All I am looking at is water and sand, Kene replied, and then waved to us to come closer and take a look. We sat on our heels for a while, looking in different directions, trying to locate what was making the sound. Without saying anything to us, Kene crawled out of the bushes and started walking on the sand toward the water. It was the Atlantic Ocean. The sound we had heard were those of the waves hitting the shore. I had seen parts of the ocean but had never stood at the shore of one this vast. It spread out beyond the vision of my eyes. The sky was at its bluest and seemed to curve down and join with the ocean in the distance. My eyes widened, a smile forming on my face. Even in the middle of the madness, there remained that true and natural beauty, and it took my mind away from my current situation as I marveled at this sight. We walked closer and sat at the edge of the sand and stared at the ocean admiring the display of waves in succession. They came in three folds. The first was small but powerful enough to break a person's leg. The second was high and more powerful than the first, and the third was a spectacle. It rolled and rose higher than the shoreline as it moved forward. We ran away from where we sat. The wave hit the shore so hard that it sent sand particles flying up in the sky. When we went back to look, the waves had thrown out unwanted flotsam from the ocean, including some big crabs that I guess weren't strong enough to cling to the ocean floor, but they were still alive. It was a calm walk along the sand, since we didn't expect trouble in this part of the country. We chased and wrestled each other in the sand, played somersault and running games. We even bundled up Elijah's old shirt and tied a rope around it to make a soccer ball. We then played a game, and each time one of us scored a goal, he would celebrate with a sukus dance. We shouted, laughed, and sang our secondary school songs. We started walking on the sandy beach early in the morning and saw the sunrise. At midday, we saw a cluster of huts ahead and raced each other toward them. When we arrived there, we suddenly became worried. There was no one in the village. Mortars lay in the sand, rice spilling out of them, jerry cans leaked water, and fires were left unattended under cooking huts. Our first guess was that the rebels might have been there. Before we could think of anything else, fishermen sprang from behind huts with machetes, fishing spears, and nets in their hands. We were so shocked by this sudden uproar that none of us was able to run. Instead, we shouted, "Please, we're harmless and just passing by," in every possible one of the 18 local languages that each of us knew. The fishermen jabbed us with the flat edges of their weapons until we fell on the ground. They sat on top of us, tied our hands, and took us to their chief. The villagers had heard a rumor that some young people believed to be rebels were heading their way. Upon hearing this, they had armed themselves and hid, waiting to defend their homes and protect their families. This should not have been a big shock to us, but we didn't expect it to happen here, since we thought we were now far from home. They asked us several questions along the lines of where we were from, where we were going, and why did we choose that direction. Alhaji, the tallest among us, and sometimes mistaken for the oldest, tried to explain to the chief that we were just passing by. Afterward, the men yanked our torn crepes off our feet, untied us and chased us out of their village, waving their spears and machetes and screaming after us. We didn't realize what sort of punishment the fishermen had given us until we stopped running away from their village. The sun was in the middle of the sky. It was over 120 degrees and we were barefoot. The humidity by the sea was less than inland, but since there were no trees to provide shade, the sun penetrated right into the sand, making it hot and loose. Walking barefoot on the sand was like walking on a hot tar road. The only escape from this pain was to keep walking and hope for something miraculous. We couldn't walk in the water or the wet sand near its edge. It was very deep between where we walked and where the water met the land, and the waves were dangerous. After I had cried for several hours, my feet became numb. I continued walking but couldn't feel the soles of my feet. We walked on the hot, burning sand until sunset. I have never longed for a day to conclude as I did that day. I thought the arrival of sunset would heal my pain, but as the heat died down, the anesthesia also wore away. Each time I lifted my feet, the veins in them tightened and I felt the sand particles digging into my bleeding soles. The next several miles were so long that I didn't think I would be able to make it. I perspired and my body shuddered from the pain. Finally, we came upon a hut that was on the sand. None of us was able to talk. We walked inside and sat down on logs around the fireplace. There were tears in my eyes, but I was unable to cry because I was too thirsty to make a sound. I looked around to see the faces of my traveling companions. They were crying as well without a sound. Hesitantly, I looked under my feet. Peeled flesh hung down and congealed blocks of blood and particles of sand clung to each hanging bit of skin. It looked as if someone had literally used a blade to cut the flesh under my feet from the heel to the toes. Discouraged, I looked into the sky, through a tiny hole in the thatched roof, trying not to think about my feet. As we sat in silence, the man whose hut we had occupied came in. He stopped at the door and was about to turn around when he noticed our suffering. His eyes met our frightened faces. Musa had just lifted his foot and was trying to separate the sand particles from his flesh. The rest of us were holding our knees so that our feet wouldn't touch the ground. The man motioned for Musa to stop what he was about to do. He shook his head and left. A few minutes later, he returned carrying a basket full of some type of grass. He quietly made a fire and heated the grasses and then placed them underneath each of our hanging feet. The steam from the grass rose to our soles and it gradually lessened the pain. The man left without saying anything. Later, he returned with fried fish soup, rice, and a bucket of water. He put the food before us and motioned for us to eat. Again, he disappeared, returning a few minutes later, this time smiling widely. He had a fishing net on his shoulder and held a pair of oars and a big flashlight. "You picking and they feel better, right?" Without waiting to hear whether we were feeling better or not, he went on to tell us where the sleeping mats were and that he was going fishing and would be back in the morning. He didn't even bother to ask our names. I guess he didn't think it was necessary or important at that moment. Before he left, he gave us ointment to rub on our feet and stressed that we do it before going to sleep. We were very quiet that night. No one said a word. The following morning, our nameless host came again with food and a smile on his face that said he was glad that we were doing fine. We couldn't walk well, so we just hobbled around the hut and made fun of each other to avoid boredom. Kene boasted about being an excellent soccer player. Musa threw him a groundnut shell. Kene moved his foot to kick it, but then realized that it would hurt and abruptly swung his foot back, dragging it against a stone. He began to blow on his sole in pain. "What kind of soccer player are you going to be if you're afraid to kick an empty groundnut shell?" Musa laughed. We all gradually began to laugh. Musa had a round face and he was short and bulky, with tiny round ears that matched his face. His eyes were big and looked as if they wanted to leave his face. Whenever he wanted to convince us of something, they would brighten. Kene had a long and calm face, and unlike Musa, he was skinny and had short, really dark hair that he took great care of every morning or whenever we stopped at a river or a stream. He would rub water on his head and take his time to carefully arrange his hair. "Are you meeting a girl somewhere?" Elijah would ask, giggling. Kene, with his soft yet authoritative voice, always seemed to know what to say and how to handle certain situations better than the rest of us. Whenever Elijah spoke, he used elaborate gestures. It was as if he wanted his already long hands to extend toward whomever he was talking to. He and Juma were friends. They walked next to each other. Juma was always nodding his head, agreeing to whatever the lanky Elijah said to him as we walked. Juma used his head to gesture rather than his hands. Whenever he spoke, he waved his head left to right. He left his hands crossed behind his back most of the time, like an old man. Saido and Moriba were almost as quiet as I. They always sat next to each other, away from the group. Saido breathed hard as we walked. His ears were large, and when he was listening, they stood up like a deer's. Moriba always told him that he must have extra hearing ability. Moriba mostly played with his hands, examining the lines on his palm and rubbing his fingers as he whispered to himself. I barely spoke. I knew Elijah, Kene, and Musa from my former secondary school. We never talked much about our past, especially our families. The few conversations we had that weren't related to our journey were mostly about soccer and school before we resumed our silence. The pains we felt from our feet subsided on the fourth night. We went for a walk around the hut, and during our stroll, I found out that the hut was only about half a mile from the main village. At night, we could see smoke rising from the tiny village's cooking huts. We stayed in the hut for a week. Our host brought us water and food every morning and night. He had the whitest teeth that I had ever seen, and he was shirtless all the time. Sometimes when he came to check on us in the morning, he had chewing sap in his mouth. I asked him one morning for his name. He laughed softly. "It is not necessary. This way we will all be safe." The following night, our host decided to take us to a part of the Atlantic Ocean that was nearby. As we walked, he engaged us in conversation. We learned that he was Shabro, one of the many tribes in Sierra Leone. When he heard the stories of how we had walked from Matrujong, he couldn't believe us. He said he had heard about the war, but still had difficulty believing that people could do the things that he had heard they did. Our host had been burned in the main village and never left. Traders came to his village with clothing items, rice, and other cooking ingredients to exchange for salt and fish, so he didn't need to go anywhere. If I had to guess, I would say he was in his early 20s. He said he was going to get married the next month and was looking forward to it. I asked why his hut was removed from the village. He explained that it was his fishing hut, where he kept his nets and other fishing items, and where he dried fish during the rainy season. When we got to the ocean, we walked to an inlet where the sea wasn't rough. We sat on the banks. "Put your foot na the water, make the salt water sukam." He also said that the salt water was good for healing the pain and preventing tetanus. Our host sat aside, looking at us, and each time I looked at him, he was smiling and his white teeth stood out against his dark face. The dry breeze from inland coupled with the cool ocean air was perfectly soothing. I wanted to know his name so badly, but I restrained myself. "You boys must come here every night to put your feet in the ocean. This way you'll be healed in less than a week," he said. He looked in the sky, where the stars were beginning to be covered by fast-moving clouds. "I have to go take care of my canoe. It will rain soon, so you must go back to the hut." He started running in the sand toward the main village. "I wish I could be that man. He's just so happy and content with his life," Elijah said. "He's a very nice man too. I really want to know his name," Kene said softly. "Yes, yes." We all agreed with Kene and went wandering into our own thoughts, which were interrupted by a sudden burst of rain. We hadn't listened to our host and left when he had told us to. We hastened to the hut. There, we sat around the fire to dry ourselves and eat dried fish. We had been with our host for 2 weeks and were feeling better when very early one morning, an older woman came to the hut. She woke us and told us to leave immediately. She said she was the mother of our host and that the people in the village had found out about us and were on their way to capture us. From the way she spoke, I could tell that she had known about us all along. She brought with her dried fish and fresh water for us to take on our journey. We didn't have enough time to thank her and tell her to thank her son for his hospitality. But from what she said, it was clear that she knew we were thankful and she cared about our safety more than anything else. "My children, you must hurry now, and my blessings are with you." Her voice was trembling with sadness, and she wiped her disconsolate face as she disappeared behind the hut and headed back to the main village. We were not fast enough to escape the men who came for us. 12 of them ran after the 7 of us, wrestling us to the sand. They tied our hands. In truth, realizing I would eventually be caught, I had stopped running and offered my hands to be tied. The man chasing me was a little taken aback. He approached me with caution and motioned another man walking behind me with a stick and a machete to pay attention. As the men tied my hands, we exchanged a glance that lasted a few seconds. I opened my eyes wide, trying to tell him that I was just a 12-year-old boy. But something in his eyes told me that he didn't care for my safety, but only for his and his village's. The men walked us to their village and made us sit outside in the sand in front of their chief. I had been through this before and wondered if it was a new experience for my present traveling companions. They were all heaving as they tried to hold back their cries. I began to worry because last time I had found someone in the village who had gone to school with us and saved us. This time we were a long way from Matrujon, a long way gone. Most of the men were shirtless, but the chief was elegantly dressed. He wore traditional cotton clothes with intricate design on the collar made of yellow and brown thread, zigzag vertically across his chest. His brown leather sandals looked new and he carried a staff with carvings of birds, canoes, all sorts of animals, and a lion's head on the handle. The chief examined us for a while, and when he caught my eye, I gave him half a smile, which he dismissed by spitting on the ground from the color nut he chewed. His voice was hoarse. "You children have become little devils, but you came to the wrong village." He used his staff to gesture instead of his hands. "Well, this is the end of the road for devils like you. Out there in the ocean, even you rascals cannot survive." "Undress them," he commanded the men who had caught us. I was trembling with fear but unable to cry. Alhaji, who stammered with terror, tried to say something, but the chief kicked the side of the stool that he sat on and proclaimed, "I do not want to hear any word from a devil." Our nameless host and his mother stood in the crowd. His mother squeezed his hand each time the chief called us devils or screamed at us. As I was being undressed, the rap cassettes fell out of my pockets, and the man who undressed me picked them up and handed them to the chief. The chief looked closely at the faces on the covers of the cassette cases. He carefully examined the Naughty by Nature cassette cover over and over, looking at the militant stance and tough expressions on the faces of the three guys standing on broken rocks with a lamppost in the background, puzzled by their poses. He demanded that a cassette player be brought. One of the men told the chief that the only way we could possess such foreign cassettes was either by having looted them or if we were mercenaries. The chief may have bought the man's first point, but he disregarded his second point, as it was utterly stupid. "These boys are no mercenaries. Look at them." The chief went back to inspecting the cassettes. I was a little glad that he had called us boys and refrained from the word devil, but I was extremely uncomfortable sitting naked in the sand. It was not a pleasant experience. Just the thought of what was happening was enough to get me agitated. I fought hard mentally to let my face show the opposite of what I felt. The flesh on my face twitched as we waited for the chief to grant us life or death. When the cassette player was brought, the chief put the cassette in and pressed play. "OPP, how can I explain it? I take you frame by frame it, to have you all jump in shall we singing it. O is for order, P is for people scratching tempo." Everyone listened attentively, raising their eyebrows and cocking their heads as they tried to understand what kind of music this was. The chief abruptly stopped the song. Some of the villagers leaned against their round mud huts, and others sat on the ground or on mortars. The men rolled the legs of their taffeta pants. Women adjusted their wrappers, and children stared at us, their hands inside their pockets or in their runny noses. "Stand them up and bring him here," the chief commanded. When I was brought closer, he asked me where I had gotten this type of music and what was the point of having it. I explained to him that it was called rap music and that myself, my brother, and my friends, not the ones I was with, used to listen to it and perform the songs at talent shows. I could tell that he found this interesting as his face was beginning to relax. He asked the men to untie me and give me my pants. "Now you show me how you, your brother, and friends did it," the chief said. I rewound the tape, mimed and danced to OPP, barefoot in the sand. I didn't enjoy it, and for the first time I found myself thinking about the words of the song, closely listening to the subtle instruments in the beat. I had never done such a thing before because I knew the words by heart and felt the beat. I didn't feel it this time. As I hopped up and down, hunched and raising my arms and feet to the music, I thought about being thrown in the ocean, about how difficult it would be to know that death was inevitable. The wrinkles on the chief's forehead began to ease. He still didn't smile, but he gave a sigh that said I was just a child. At the end of the song, he rubbed his beard and said that he was impressed with my dancing and found the singing interesting. He asked for the next cassette to be played. It was LL Cool J. I mimed the song I Need Love. When I'm alone in my room, sometimes I stare at the wall, and in the back of my mind, I hear my conscience call. The chief turned his head from side to side as if trying to understand what I was saying. I watched him to see if his face was going to change for the worse, but a look of amusement flickered on his face. He ordered that all my friends be untied and given back their clothes. The chief explained to everyone that there had been a misunderstanding and that we were only children looking for safety. He wanted to know if we had stayed in the hut of our own accord or if the owner knew about us. I told him that we had stayed there on our own and that we hadn't come in contact with anyone until that morning. The chief told us that he was letting us go, but that we had to leave the area immediately. He gave me back my cassettes, and we were on our way. As we walked, we examined the rope marks on our wrist and laughed about what had happened to avoid crying. Chapter 10. One of the unsettling things about my journey, mentally, physically, and emotionally, was that I wasn't sure when or where it was going to end. I didn't know what I was going to do with my life. I felt that I was starting over and over again, I was always on the move, always going somewhere. While we walked, I sometimes lagged behind, thinking about these things. To survive each passing day was my goal in life. At villages where we managed to find some happiness by being treated to food or fresh water, I knew that it was temporary and that we were only passing through. So I couldn't bring myself to be completely happy. It was much easier to be sad than to go back and forth between emotions, and this gave me the determination I needed to keep moving. I was never disappointed since I always expected the worst to happen. There were nights when I couldn't sleep but stared into the darkest night until my eyes could see clearly through it. I thought about where my family was and whether they were alive. One night, while I sat outside in a village square thinking about how far I had come and what might lie ahead, I looked into the sky and saw how the thick clouds kept trying to cover the moon. Yet it would reappear again and again to shine all night long. In some way, my journey was like that of the moon, although I had even more thick clouds coming my way to make my spirit dull. I remembered something that Saidu had said one evening after we had survived another attack by men with spears and axes. Juma, Moriba, and Musa were asleep on the veranda we occupied. Alhaji, Kine, Saidu, and I were awake and quietly listening to the night. Saidu's heavy breathing made our silence less unbearable. After a few hours had gone by, Saidu spoke in a very deep voice, as if someone were speaking through him. "How many more times do we have to come to terms with death before we find safety?" he asked. He waited for a few minutes, but the three of us didn't say anything. He continued, "Every time people come at us with the intention of killing us, I close my eyes and wait for death. Even though I am still alive, I feel like each time I accept death, part of me dies. Very soon I will completely die, and all that will be left is my empty body walking with you. It will be quieter than I am." Saidu blew on the palms of his hands to warm them and lay on the floor. His heavy breathing intensified and I knew he had fallen asleep. Gradually, Kine and then Alhaji fell asleep. I sat on a wooden bench against the wall and thought about Saidu's words. Tears formed in my eyes and my forehead became warm, thinking about what Saidu had said. I tried not to believe that I too was dying, slowly, on my way to find safety. The only time I was able to fall asleep that night was when the last morning breeze, the one containing the irresistible urge to sleep, saved me from my wandering mind. Even though our journey was difficult, every once in a while, we were able to do something that was normal and made us happy for a brief moment. One morning we arrived at a village where the men were getting ready to go hunting. They invited us to join them. At the end of the hunt, one of the older men shouted, pointing at us, "We are going to feast tonight and the strangers are welcome to stay." The other men clapped and began walking on the path back to the village. We walked behind them. They sang, carrying their nets and animals, mostly porcupines and deer that had been caught, on their shoulders. Upon our arrival at the village, the women and children clapped to welcome us. It was past midday. The sky was blue and the wind was beginning to pick up. Some of the men shared the meat among several households, and the rest was given to the women to be cooked for the feast. We hung about in the village and fetched water for the women who were preparing the food. Most of the men had returned to work the farms. I walked around the village by myself and found a hammock on one of the verandas. I lay in it, swinging slowly to get my thoughts in motion. I began to think about the times when I visited my grandmother and would sleep in the hammock at the farm. I would wake up staring into her eyes as she played with my hair. She would tickle me and then hand me a cucumber to eat. Junior and I would sometimes fight for the hammock, and if he got it, I would trick him by loosening its ropes so that he would fall once he sat in it. This would discourage him, and he would go about the farm doing something else. My grandmother knew about my tricks and made fun of me, calling me Kasiloi, which means spider. In many Mende stories, the spider is the character that tricks other animals to get what he wants, but his tricks always backfire on him. As I was thinking about these things, I fell out of the hammock. I was too lazy to get up, so I sat on the ground and thought about my two brothers, my father, mother, and grandmother. I wished to be with them. I put my hands behind my head and lay on my back, trying to hold on to the memories of my family. Their faces seemed to be far off somewhere in my mind, and to get to them, I had to bring up painful memories. I longed for the gentle, dark, and shiny old hands of my grandmother, my mother's tight and close embrace during the times I visited her, as if hiding and protecting me from something. My father's laughter when we played soccer together and when he sometimes chased me in the evening with a bowl of cold water to get me to take a shower. My older brother's arms around me when we walked to school and when he sometimes elbowed me to stop me from saying things I would regret. And my little brother, who looked exactly like me and would sometimes tell people that his name was Ishmael when he did something wrong. I had trouble conjuring up these thoughts, and when I finally ventured into these memories, I became so sad that the bones in my body started to ache. I went to the river, dove into the water, and sat at the bottom, but my thoughts followed me. In the evening, after everyone had returned to the village, the food was brought outside to the village square. It was divided among plates, and 7 people ate from each plate. After the meal, the villagers started playing drums, and we all joined hands and danced in circles under the moonlight. During an interval, after several songs, one of the men announced that when the dancing had been exhausted, whenever that would be, he jokingly said, the